just a privilege to get to spend some time.
Thank you for listening to For the Wild podcast. The music you heard today was by Andy Talent, Handmade Moments, and Ella Spaulding. For the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Francesca Glasspell, and Julia Jackson.
Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, lovers of jazz. I am Marcia Hawker, your host for Jazz Lives. On Wednesday, March 29th, I will be joined by Jan Mancuso with research by Paula Walker in honoring the contributions of women in jazz, blues, Latin grooves, and gospel. Voices Without a Voice will cover a woman's place and men's permission. This special four-hour program will air on Wednesday, March 29th, beginning at 12:08 p.m. right here on KBOO 90.7 FM and streaming on KBOO.fm.
Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Professor Francis Boyle talks about his role as a prosecutor for an international tribunal organized in Malaysia, which found George W. Bush and Tony Blair guilty of crimes against humanity for their bloody role in the Iraq War 20 years ago today. In this context, Boyle also calls out the hypocrisy of the ICC's indictment today of Putin of Russia as a potential war criminal. And Iraq 20 years after, Sam Husseini on the lies and lies about the lies about the invasion. And we'll have an update on the criminal element in Israel that's taken over the government and carrying out one brutality after another. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you out of the San Francisco Bay Area. We are live today in San Francisco and Los Angeles and down the coast. Happy to have you with us. And we are really grateful to welcome back to these airwaves Professor Francis Boyle. Professor Boyle is a law he's a law professor, teaches international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. He's written many important books, most recently World Politics, Human Rights, and International Law. Professor Boyle, really good to have you back with us. You've got a lot to say about what's going on in terms of this remaking of what happened 20 years ago in Iraq. It's absolutely disgusting. And I want to jump into that. But before we do, I have to just get a gut take from you. You know as much about what's going on in the Middle East in terms of the expanding Israeli occupation. You've seen this unfolding over so many years. You've represented the Palestinians. Can I get your take on where we are now with this criminal government in charge in Israel?
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Dennis. My best to your listening audience. Just before he died, I called up the chairman of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace negotiations, Dr. Haider Abdel Shafi, my client and friend, to get his last words of wisdom. And I won't go through it all here. He lived in Gaza. And he said, quote, "The Zionists have not changed their agenda since the Baal Conference of 1897, unquote. And I think that's correct. This is a man who personally directed, negotiated with them, that the agenda here still is all of Palestine that they want, and as few Palestinians as possible. So this agenda is still going on today and is accelerating as we speak."
Yeah, it's sad, but we're going to hear more about that later. But again, Professor Boyle, happy to have you with us today. There is a myth, multiple myths about the Gulf War. We'll also be joined in a moment by Sam Husseini to have you with us. But I was hoping that we could start off with you trying to sort of unravel some of the myths about the Iraq war. We haven't heard much about the phony weapons of mass destruction or what really happened. But let's hear a little bit about about this from then Senator Joe Biden, who was Mr. Cheerleader number one for that war, although nobody's talking about that now.
"Saddam is dangerous. The world would be a better place without him. But the reason he poses a growing danger to the United States and its allies is that he possesses chemical and biological weapons and is seeking, with his $2 billion a year illegally skimmed from the UN Fund for Food, his oil for food program, for peace program, that he is seeking nuclear weapons. And for years now, he has prevented the United Nations inspectors from uncovering those weapons and verifying Iraq's disarmament. And he is in violation of the terms he agreed to, allowing him to stay in power."
All right. Maybe we could just start there. You want to, before we talk about why you effectively prosecuted George W. Bush for the war, you want to help us unravel some of the big lies, some of the myths. There were no weapons of mass destruction related to the war or the war effort.
Right, Dennis. As a matter of fact, I and other members of the peace movement publicly stated, starting in the fall of 2002, in the run-up to the war on these grounds, that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. And I said that I was the person who called for and then drafted the U.S. implementing legislation for the Biological Weapons Convention, known as the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, that was passed unanimously by both houses of the United States Congress and signed into law by President George Bush Senior with the approval of the U.S. Department of Justice. So the people in Washington, D.C., in Congress, the House and the Senate, Biden, everyone in the Bush Jr. administration, they knew full well there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That was a matter of public record. I said that. Indeed, I was on a national debate on Pacifica Radio Network in October 2002 for an entire hour debating with the top Republican honcho at that time, lawyer David Rifkin, who worked for Reagan and Bush Sr., he still writes in the Wall Street Journal. I said quite clearly, there were no weapons of mass destruction. This was not a case of an intelligence failure or ignorance or anything like that. They all knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and they wanted that war. Indeed, on March 2003, just before the war started, Congressman John Conyers convened an emergency meeting of the top 40 to 50 lawyers and legal advisors in the Democratic Party to debate my bill of impeachment against Bush Jr. to stop the war. And he invited Ramsey Clark and me to come in and argue the case for impeachment. It was a two-hour debate. Ramsey and I on one side arguing for impeachment, and everyone else the other side against it. And finally, John Podesta came in, who had been Clinton's chief of staff at the White House and later director of Mrs. Clinton's presidential campaign, and now working for Joe Biden, saying that the Democratic National Committee was against any bill of impeachment against Bush Jr. So after 2 hours of debate, it came out, we came out, Ramsey and I said, you know, Ramsey, I don't understand it. Why didn't these people take me up on my offer to stick around, polish up the bill of impeachment in light of some of their criticisms, and put it in right away to stop this war? And Ramsey very somberly said, I think most of the people there wanted a war. So even the Democrats, the liberal Democrats, wanted a war. And all the liberal Democrats were there. I don't think John Conyers wanted a war, but pretty much as Ramsey saw it, everyone else did there. And I won't mention the names, but I'll never forget who they are. And certainly Podesta made it clear that the Democratic National Committee wanted a war too. So this had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. It had to do with two points. Sam Huntington pointed this out in his Clash of Civilizations. I went through the same PhD program at Harvard that produced Huntington before me. I would not study him with him as a matter of principle because of his diehard support for the Vietnam War. But Huntington was a typical Harvard imperial apparatchik, a lot of influence with state, Pentagon, CIA, et cetera. And he said, first, Iraq was the only country in the Middle East who could stand up against the United States and Israel. And second, we wanted to make the Persian Gulf an American lake for oil and gas, and that's exactly what we did.
It's exactly what happened there, huh? You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Professor Francis Boyle. Professor Boyle, would you please talk a little bit about the case that you tried against George W. Bush and Tony Blair? Can you just outline the case and why you thought that it was an effective case and a true case of crimes against humanity?
Right. Well, there were two prosecutions out there in Malaysia involving the Bush Jr. War against Iraq. The Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal was set up pursuant to Malaysian law. They had rules of procedure, a professional staff. They had a prosecution, and there was a defense team of experienced Malaysian barristers who were paid to represent the defendants. The first proceeding was against Bush and Blair for a war of aggression and a Nuremberg crime against peace and war crimes against Iraq for starting the war. And there were two lead prosecutors, one a Malaysian professor of international law and the other me. The trial took place for about 5 days. As I said, there was a team of Malaysian barristers who were hired and paid to defend Bush and Blair. And at the end of the day, we won. And they were found guilty unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt. I should point out that these proceedings were filed with the International Criminal Court, and of course they did nothing. The second against Bush and Blair. By the way, I should also point out that a team of British lawyers filed a complaint with the International Criminal Court against Tony Blair for all his crimes in Iraq. I was not on the team. They asked me my opinion. I gave my advice. I read the complaint. It was a meritorious complaint. It was just dismissed. They paid no attention at all to it. The second set of prosecutions in Malaysia was for the Bush torture scandal. Bush Jr., Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, the head of the CIA. And then I also made sure in there were the lawyers like Bybee, John Yoo, Goldsmith, and some of the others. Once again, the two lead prosecutors was a Malaysian professor of international law and me. They had appointed for them defense attorneys there, experienced barristers from Malaysia, indeed then added one from Australia, and they all paid and they put on the vigorous defense. But of course, the evidence was overwhelming, indeed, even based on official United States government documents, and we won that as well unanimously. Those proceedings were also put on file with the International Criminal Court, and of course they did nothing against any of them.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Professor Francis Boyle. And again, we are delighted to have him along. We're talking about Iraq 20 years after the war. The fact that the International Criminal Court has now indicted Putin for war crimes. I guess, Professor Boyle, you see a bit of an inequity here, disingenuousness, if you will, in terms of treating Putin versus the way in which a potential war criminal like George W. Bush gets treated?
Well, Dennis, I'm not here to excuse or justify any war crimes in Ukraine, but this is a case of what we lawyers call lawfare, that the United States, Britain, the European Union states that pay for the ICC, not the U.S., but the others, they are using this indictment as a form of legal warfare against the Russian head of state. And I should note that certainly the United States, all the NATO states, the European Union states, these are now co-belligerents with Ukraine against Russia. But to put this in context, Dennis, despite all the massive death and destruction for the last 20 years perpetrated by the West, they have never indicted. The ICC has never indicted one American. They have never indicted one Brit. They have never indicted one head of a European state or head of government. They have never indicted anyone from NATO. They have never indicted anyone from Australia. And they have certainly not indicted any Israeli leaders. After Operation Cast Lead, I advised the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, to accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. Which he did. Well, that was what, 13 years ago or more? And the ICC has not lifted one finger to help the Palestinians. They have not indicted even one Israeli official for war crimes and crimes against humanity. What can I say? The ICC hasn't lifted a finger to help the people of Iraq. 1.5 million or so were exterminated by Bush and Blair. Afghanistan, maybe a million were blown away by the United States and the NATO states in Afghanistan. They've done nothing to help the people of Syria, 500,000 because of Obama's aggression against Syria. They've done nothing to help the people of Yemen. That was all Obama and the Saudis doing. They've done nothing to help the people of Libya. Again, that was Obama and all of Europe, the NATO states. Nothing. Zip, zero. And they've done nothing to help Somalia, despite all the military intervention in there by the United States government. So it's clear this is just political lawfare against the Russian president to demonize him, vilify him, and make it extremely difficult for there to be a negotiated peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine.
That's Professor Francis Boylan. Francis, I want to welcome in to this discussion Sam Husseini, who has been watching this very closely. I know he has a couple of questions for you, but let me start, Sam, with a question for you. What are the other big names in the big lie that you might want to work into the mix beyond Bush Cheney? And maybe you want to ask Francis a question as well.
Sure. Other than Bush and Cheney themselves and the cadre around them, so-called neocons, Biden really was a main leader. John Kerry was really a main leader. People who, technically voted against the war but helped enable it. Here I'm thinking about Nancy Pelosi. They voted against the so-called authorization, but perpetrated the lies that led to war, never came clean about helping to perpetrate the lies, and then sort of covered up for Bush and Cheney's tracks afterwards so that there was never a meaningful holding to account for them. So it was sort of a soft landing for the system. And of course, you eventually had the Obama presidency, and there again, no prosecution there either, nor a signing on, as Professor Boyle rightly points out, to the ICC. So it's, Bush and Cheney were sort of the tip of the spear, along with the neocons like Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith and Richard Perle. Sort of pulling the trigger, but there was a whole mechanism that basically included, the entire Congress or the strong majority of Congress. Biden not only made, statements that you pointed out there, but he also presided over these rigged hearings that basically made the case for war. I tried to question him about it once, and he cut off the questioning, and then one of his staffers basically came up and ran interference, so I couldn't get a follow-up and lied to me in the process, telling me that, the hearings, they asked every tough question and all of this stuff. I didn't realize until afterwards that it was Tony Blinken, who's now Secretary of State. He was a Biden staffer at the time. But there were so many lies, and there were lies about lies. That it was bad intel, that the U.S. was hoodwinked by a couple of Iraqis, even that the war was a failure. When I think in cold Machiavellian terms, it was a success. It destabilized the Middle East in a way that the U.S. establishment wanted. It fostered the military-industrial complex. It led to the Middle East that we see now, that's dominated by Israel and Saudi Arabia in large part. And I should say that assessment, I just spoke with Catherine Gunn. I did an interview with Catherine Gunn, the great whistleblower that's on my Substack, and she shared that assessment that, you know, that it was a success in cold Machiavellian terms. And and you know, there was also the lie that, oh, now we know that Bush lied after the war. I know a bunch of Soros-funded groups put that line out after the invasion. Now we know Bush lied. No, it was clear that Bush was lying during the build-up to the war. He was making clearly false statements. So I think that, that there really is a situation where there were lies and there were lies about the lies that in effect covered up for the entire system. Absolutely.
And this cover-up, that's the voice of Sam Husseini, who works with the Institute for Public Accuracy and does his own column for Substack. And he has been writing effectively about the big cover-up 20 years later. We also have Professor Francis Boyle. And because, Professor Boyle, there has been such a lack of honest and real reporting, some of the key, you might say, criminals from the war, from the Bush administration, have survived and are thriving. You tend to do a shout-out to Professor John Yoo. He was the torture man for the Bush administration. We now have, it's interesting, Nicole Wallace. She was special communications director for Bush, too. I think they were involved in stuff like torture and all that. Your thoughts on the way in which the lack of telling the truth leads to the continuing kinds of horrific policies?
Well, it's a disgrace, Dennis, that we have not held these people accountable. I did start a campaign to try to get Bush and some of the others indicted for committing murder against U.S. armed forces. You can read the basis for this in my book, Tackling America's Toughest Questions. I still think this would be possible, Bush, Cheney, and some of the others under the common law definition of murder, malice aforethought. There were at least close to 5,000 U.S. troops. I think the number's much higher. The Pentagon always lies about casualties, but take a minimum of 5,000. I would encourage the next of kin of those troops who were murdered by Bush, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and the rest of them to go into their state and local prosecutors and demand indictments for murder and conspiracy to commit murder. I had lined up a team of lawyers in Massachusetts to do this against Rumsfeld. I had done all the research, everything like that. Rumsfeld was coming for a speech. I had a team ready to go. And at the last minute, they chickened out. I never got any explanation why. Maybe they were threatened. I really don't know. But there is no statute of limitations for murder, so I would still encourage anyone who lost a loved one over in Iraq to pursue indictments for murder against Bush, Cheney, Rice, Tenet, the head of the CIA, and the rest of them. They are in the Kuala Lumpur war crimes tribunal proceedings. You can get them at the Perdana Peace Foundation, P-E-R-D-A-N-A, Peace Foundation in Malaysia. And you could also read my book, Tackling America's Toughest Questions, where I outline the murder cases against these people in accordance with traditional Anglo-American common law principles surrounding murder. I was originally hired here to teach criminal law. And I taught it for maybe 8 years before I moved into international human rights law. But if you're still ticked off about the Iraq war, murder is the way to go. There's no statute of limitations on murder.
Can I jump in with one or two more points?
Yes, go on, Sam, please.
Sure. And then I do actually do have a question for Professor Boyle. You know, just to really highlight how much forethought went into of the invasion of Iraq, that it wasn't had intelligence or the like. I mentioned Catherine Gunn before. She was a whistleblower. She was working with GCHQ, the British equivalent of the NSA, and she put out what Dan Ellsberg called the most important leak of all time. It was a short memo in early 2003, basically calling for a spy surge against the other members of the UN Security Council. The U.S. was trying to get the other members of the Security Council to authorize the invasion of Iraq. And so the U.S. and Britain were violating international law by trying to get information to either blackmail or coerce or bribe the other members of the U.N. Security Council to pressure them to vote for the war. Well, she exposed that memo. It got very little play in the United States, but it ended up getting play in those respective countries, Mexico, Chile, several African countries, and so on. And it, in large part, was probably responsible for them failing to get that authorization. So if people might remember, Bush started the war by saying, Saddam Hussein, you got to leave Iraq, and then sort of mumbling, but we're going to bomb either way. You know, there was no justification, that there was no, you know, legal, you know, phony legal, you know, imprimatur to proceed with this. And another thing that really highlights the length to which they went was on my Substack, I have me questioning Pelosi, and I also have a clip of me questioning Powell after the invasion. Powell, in his UN presentation, he presented evidence, so-called evidence, that was procured by torture. They tortured a guy, this guy Sheikh Alibi, into saying that Iraq and al-Qaeda were working together, that Powell presented at the UN. They actually got the Egyptians to do it. So they don't make stuff up out of whole cloth. they torture false confessions, like, you know, the most crooked cops you could possibly imagine, in order to make this phony case for war. So it was an incredibly elaborate series of diabolical schemes to push for war.
Yeah, very clear about it, to state the point, torture became, under Bush II, a key forward-fighting tool of the United States government in its war-making. Torture was now built in. And, I mean, we owe Francis Boyle a lot in terms of really, you know, getting us hip to the fact that a guy by the name of John Yoo was structurally creating laws that were going to haunt us and wars and the people who fought wars for a long time.
Absolutely, but it also highlights that the, you know, sort of liberal critique of torture is also wrong. Because liberals and some so-called conservatives like Powell and like John McCain, who say that they're against torture, they say torture doesn't work. That's not true. Torture does work in producing false but useful information, false confessions that the U.S. government, in this case, finds that they can exploit into, you know, putting out information that they want to put out. So torture does actually work in a completely perverse sort of way. I wanted Professor Boyle to highlight the role of the ICC. Until now, I think this is the first non-African that the ICC has issued, has either indicted or issued an arrest warrant. It's been all of these Africans up until now who they've gone after. It's you know, it's quite, you know, quite comical almost how, you know, how explicitly biased it's been, that the U.S. invades country after country and the ICC does nothing, Israel, Saudi Arabia, but all of these Africans have gotten indicted. If Professor Boyle could speak to that.
Right. In my book, World Politics, Human Rights, and International Law, I have a chapter entitled International Criminal Court, the White Man's Court. In Africa, they see the bias here, that basically white racist former colonial imperial powers use the ICC as a tool to go after black tin pot dictators in Africa. That's what the ICC has been doing. Now they're going after Putin. But Sam, I did want to return to the point you made. You used the word forethought, and that's exactly correct. The mens rea, the guilty mind element of murder, is malice aforethought. And there is no problem in my mind in proving malice aforethought necessary for murder for Bush Jr., Cheney, Rice, Tenet, Alberto Gonzalez, and some of the others involved here. As for torture, sure. I helped defend Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia, who was the first GI resistor to participation in Bush Jr.'s Gulf War because he did not want to become an aider and abettor to torture over there in Iraq. He was in combat, captured insurgents, turned them over, and they were being tortured at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. So we did have a full trial of the Bush Jr. Torture matter at his court-martial down at Fort Stewart, Georgia. He was facing 2 years for desertion. He didn't desert, for sure. And after it came through a court proceeding, he got 8 months, I think, because I had established it, to the satisfaction of the military jury, that the torture went all the way up the chain of command to Bush Jr. himself and his Federalist Society lawyers like John Mew. The other point on torture and the International Criminal Court, as you know, in 2010, I filed a complaint with the ICC against Bush and all the rest of them for their policy of extraordinary rendition, which was a euphemism for the enforced disappearance of human beings and torture, okay? And it was a 96-page complaint. I proceeded to supplement it over the years, including the executive summary produced by the Senate Intelligence Committee that was close to 500 pages long, and eventually the preceding ICC prosecutor, Madam Bansuda from Gambia, got permission from the court to open an investigation against Bush and all the rest of them for their policy of extraordinary rendition in throughout Europe, which primarily were ICC member states, and Afghanistan. What happened? The new ICC prosecutor, who's a British lawyer, comes in, and obviously the fix is in at that point, and he dismisses that complaint. So notice, we have them slam dunk on the record, torture, official U.S. government documents, and enforced disappearance of human beings, all the CIA black sites, kidnapping. I have a 96-page complaint in there, supplemented over the years, and he just dismisses it, his first act as ICC prosecutor. So again, no Americans have ever been indicted for anything, no Brits, no Europeans, no NATO leaders, no one from Australia, and certainly no one from Israel.
Are the people, Francis, that make the case that's, you know, the communications department for Bush 2, for the war, the people who solidified the lie, are they responsible? Can they be prosecuted, or should they be a little worried about information having to do with torture and the second Iraq war?
Well, you know, the problem, as I see it, is that we first have to get the principles. These people would be accountable for aiding and abetting. However, there were prosecutions at Nuremberg for Nazi propagandists like Rosenberg. That I think he was in charge of Der Sturmer and others. And there have been prosecutions in the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda for media types, people who appear on media and aid and abet and promote and facilitate war crimes, genocide, and things of that nature. So, yes, cases can be made. But we need to get the principles first before we can, you know, we can get those involved in what are called inchoate crimes, aiding and abetting, facilitating, and things of that nature.
I mean, I'm just thinking, for instance, members of the Bush administration figure heavily into the Biden administration. You've got, and into the media now. You've got somebody like Nicole Wallace, who was the special communications director for Bush 2. She does 2 hours a day on MSNBC. Now, I don't, you know, maybe she hasn't done anything, but I'm thinking that if you're the communications director of an administration that has made torture a key part of its foreign policy, that these folks could be maybe held responsible or no?
Well, they should be, but it's hard. If we can't get Bush, well, Cheney's now dead. Rumsfeld's not dead. Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, John Yoo, who has the most distinguished endowed chair at Berkeley Law School, which is a disgrace, it's going to be hard to get these secondary figures. I can tell you I've tried to get the principals involved in both the war itself and the torture scandal, and yet so far they're still out running around getting promotions.
It's amazing. Sam, final word. And then I'm going to give the last word to Frances.
Sure. I mean, I think all of this speaks to, you know, some level of accountability, and it's not about history. It's about the future, too, because when you don't have accountability for this, you're sowing the seeds of future wars. If the top officials in the United States know they can get away with it, and globally as well, then that's our future. So that really highlights how important this is. And the point about, you know, media is, so crucial. I mean, the U.S. media was crucial in propagandizing for the Iraq war, just like every other war. But I think that was a real high point or low point, as you like. And the need to, you know, be supporting independent media like Flashpoints and KPFA. Because of Flashpoints, I've been getting into the State Department and asking tough questions to really try to turn the tide as much as we possibly can, and posting that on my Substack, Hussaini.substack.com. And, you know, we just need those structures to really get out there and to propagate some serious analysis if we're to have a different future.
Well, we're grateful to you, and we are endlessly grateful to Professor Frances Boyle. Final word. This is, who would have thought we'd be at this place here in 2023, Frances, with a maniac who tried to overthrow the government running for president? Where are we?
Dennis, let me be prospective here, in that we now have to analyze what's going on in Ukraine in light of the past. We're just seeing so much lies, disinformation going out now, including this lawfare pursued by the United States government against President Putin, when, as Sam pointed out, even Biden and his people, the Bidenites, like Blinken, are dripping with blood from their head to their toes. And we simply cannot be deceived by these people. We have to understand that in December of 2021, Russia sent two treaties to the United States and NATO states. I read these treaties. Basically, all they were demanding was a security guarantee that Ukraine would remain neutral. That's all they wanted. That was the heart of it. Lavrov admitted that. And the Bidenites refused to negotiate in good faith over those treaties and that guarantee, which they are still refusing today, still ruling out negotiations. And this despite the fact that Jim Baker under Bush Jr. gave a binding legal pledge to Soviet Commissar Gorbachev that NATO would not expand even one inch to the east. And that was abandoned immediately by Bill Clinton, and they expanded NATO right up to the borders of Russia. So again, we can learn something, I think, the modus operandi of the United States government, which is lies, threats, bullying, intimidation, harassment, and blackmail. And I have been up against the United States government. I was legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace negotiations for the 2 years there. That's exactly what the United States government did to the Palestinians. Lies, threats, bullying, intimidation, a total dishonest broker. And I was the lawyer for the Bosnians during their peace negotiations. The United States government, this was under Clinton, tried to destroy Bosnia as a state, rob it of its UN membership, and subject 1.5 to 2 million more Bosnians to ethnic cleansing. Well, we already had 2 million Bosnian victims. Likewise, the war against Serbia. There were no reasonable good faith negotiations there at the time. I was advising the Kosovar delegation to Rambier peace talks. And what happened, Madeleine Albright issued an ultimatum to the Serbian government, knowing full well Serbia could not accept this ultimatum. I read it. There's no self-respecting state could have accepted an ultimatum like that. And then we proceeded to bomb them. Likewise, in Gulf War I, an ultimatum was made to Saddam Hussein deliberately that they knew he could not accept. That was Fuad Ajami and also Richard Haass stepping down now as head of Council for Foreign Relations. And again, in Gulf War II under Bush Jr., they made another ultimatum to Saddam Hussein that they knew he couldn't accept and then proceeded to bomb it. So this is the way the United States government conducts foreign affairs. I've also tried to help the Libyans. The same thing there. So, you know, what can I say? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I don't think we should be fooled here by Biden and the Bidenites when it comes to Ukraine now with this drone. A war plane sent in provocatively into a zone of hostilities without their transit boundary on. It could be armed. It was definitely on a spy mission. And the United States is a co-belligerent of Ukraine. So, of course, they shot it down. They had every right under the laws of war to shoot it down. And yet you have pure hysteria here in the United States over the weekend and almost no dissent at all. So history is repeating itself.
Amazing. Well, Professor Boyle, I cannot tell you how grateful we are because you are amazing and the information you share with us is so crucial. And you've been there on the front line. You're not somebody who just sits back and talks about this stuff. And you do wonderful work as a teacher and I know as a poet well. But I'm really glad that we were able to contact you. And also, Sam Husseini, thanks for helping us put this together. Sam now works, does some reporting from Washington, our Washington correspondent. We're happy to have him along. He's a senior analyst with the Institute for Public Accuracy. And again, Professor Boyle's written about a zillion books, and they're all worth reading. We thank both of you for joining us on Flashpoints. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to have an in-depth report on the latest brutalities of the criminal government that is now in the midst of cleansing, expanding the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Stay with us. bring up the ghost. That's DJ Shadow on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. And we do turn our attention back to occupied Palestine and Israel. The brutality of the current, Richard Silverstein, when I say a criminal government, I guess, are they convicted yet? Or I guess that's why Netanyahu is canceling the powers of the courts to avoid conviction. But can you bring us up to speed? How can we understand what's been happening lately on the ground? What's it looking like?
Well, we're now in the 11th week in a row where hundreds of thousands of Israelis have come out on the streets, not only on the streets whenever Netanyahu announces that he's going to take a foreign trip. They don't permit him to get to the airport because they basically drive their cars to the roads leading to the airports and stop their cars so that no vehicles can get to the airport. So he has to take a helicopter to avoid the hundreds of thousands of people that are opposed to his rule. We now have we have military officers, active duty officers, who are saying that they are not going to continue to serve if they have to under a fascist government. We have the beginnings of a civil insurrection without arms or violence so far. I want to also add a very important development. Yesterday was that an American, an Israeli-American, a former Marine who decided to become an Israeli citizen, he moved to one of the three most violent and homicidal settlements on the West Bank, a place called Itamar. He was just attacked by a Palestinian who tried to kill him. And this guy is an American citizen. And so you can read on social media people who are aggrieved and angry that a so-called Palestinian terrorist would have the temerity to attack an American citizen. But let's not forget, this guy is a Marine. He was training settlers how to kill Palestinians, and there should be no mercy for anyone doing the kinds of things that he did.
All right. The new government wasn't kidding around in terms of their vision, what their vision was for Palestine and Israel, and they are carrying forth. You say it's difficult for them to move around, but it's not difficult for them to expand the imposition of this kind of violence. They seem to be unchecked, and the Americans are like under a table somewhere looking the other way. Well, not even, they're supporting it in a way.
Yeah, I think that that's true. The U.S. government has pretty much given Israel carte blanche. It's sort of nibbled around the edges a little bit and said expressed concern here and there. Whenever an Israeli is killed in an attack, Tom Knights, the ambassador, gives his full-throated, support and prayers and all the other things they talk about. But, when a Palestinian is killed, which happens virtually every day, we hear very little from the Americans. There is one important media development to tell you about, and that is that the New York Times, which is usually asleep at the wheel when it comes to Israel and Palestine, has finally decided that what's going on is important enough that they can talk about the American angle, which is a billion hedge fund in New York was founded by Roger Hertog, who's a MAGA Republican. billionaire founder of the brokerage firm Sander Bernstein, I believe. He founded a foundation called the Tikva Fund, and Tikva Fund has been proposing all of the fascist legislative agenda that Israel is proposing, the ability to for the Supreme Court to be denied the ability to oversee laws that are passed and determine whether they're constitutional or not, and various other misogynist legislation that's being proposed, legislation would take away the right to have an independent body nominate judges, and that would also fall to the Prime Minister himself to be able to do that. So this is actually two American billionaires of the Tikva Fund have been responsible for this whole entire fascist agenda. Finally, the New York Times, about a month after Haaretz did, has told its readers about these Jewish billionaires, pro-Israel billionaires, who are trying to turn Israel into a fascist state.
Well, Richard, it really is troubling. Where is the foreign policy establishment? They seem to be frozen totally. And where's Blinken? What's he saying about these expanding killing fields? Does anybody think this is going to get better? Netanyahu's not kidding around. Is anybody doubting him now? Does anybody have any doubts about what his policy is all about? Do the Americans have a single question about where this is going? And the only way we're ever going to know if they really care, if they actually do a little aid cutting, because we know Israel's number one in aid in the world. This little muscle gets as much aid as any other country around. So where does this end except in tragedy?
I don't think that the world is taking enough notice of what's going on. We hear very little. I think that the Europeans care a little bit, and the U.S. sort of cares a little bit, but not enough to really do anything. And part of this is because we have the Israel lobby in Washington that basically controls U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine. And the legislators in Washington don't lift a finger unless AIPAC tells them that it's okay to do that. And AIPAC is basically under the direction of the Likud. So, you have a foreign government basically with the assistance of American Jews running U.S. foreign policy. So a president can't lift a finger unless the Israel lobby tells him that it can. And if a legislator dares to lift his voice or say anything, do anything, propose anything that violates the Israel lobby parameters, then they will get primaried. Not only primaried, there will be tens of millions of dollars that will be spent in those primaries to support the pro-Israel candidate, which they find and they recruit, who will run against them. So in that sense, you can't sort of fault legislators who don't really rise to the occasion and do the right thing, because they know they'll be defeated if they do.
They get crushed. There's no messing around, and there is, with this upsurge of anti-Semitism in the United States, it's easy to do a whole bunch of shape-shifting, blame-shaping, and life gets even more complicated, wouldn't you say? We have a minute.
Well, I would say that that things are going to get worse. The question is going to be how long this government can last. I would say that it's likely that it's going to be toppled, but that's hard to say. We're really we're careening towards a cliff here. This is a runaway train that is proposing this legislation, which is almost ready to be finally passed, and then the Supreme Court is going to veto it, and then we have to see what's going to happen after that.
Well, all right. We're going to leave it right there. Thank you for taking the time out. We've been speaking with Richard Silverstein, and he blogs at Tikkun Olam and writes for various wonderful publications like The Middle East Eye, New Arab, Jacobin Magazine. Thank you, Richard. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dennis. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. And guess what? You've been listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we spent another hour hopefully bringing you the kind of material that means something to you. And we're not afraid to tell the truth about that war 20 years ago that the United States wanted, just like they wanted this war with Russia. Oh, yeah, they did. They did. We're out of here.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, March 25th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. for our 2023 Bluegrass Marathon, live at Multnomah Grain 71.